When a child is born, he is protected from the vagaries of existence by the benevolence of circumstance through maternal presence. The infant is prepared, a priori, instinctively, to respond to such protection and to form a relationship, a bond with the mother. The helpless baby is at the mother's mercy, but is sheltered as well from the terrible world. Culture intercedes in the form of proscriptions on behavior when mortality nonetheless threatens, but adherence to such requirements means increased responsibility, separation from the good mother, and sacrifice of the primary dependent relationship. Culture molds the maturing personality, offering knowledge, but at the same time limitation, as the social world mangles individuality, interest, and meaning. Spirit is offered up to the group to maintain the group's benevolent nature, ensuring its continued protection and its grant of knowledge derived from history. It is necessary to identify with the group in the course of normal development. That identification fosters maturity and separation from blind maternal solicitude. But ultimately, the group is tyrannical and demands obedience at the cost of unique being. This is not to say naively that the group is intrinsically evil, that the root of human suffering is buried in the ground of the social world. Society is more purely expansion of power, which may be directed according to individual choice. The past contains within it the behavioral wisdom of generations established in pain and fear, and offers the possibility of immense extension of individual power and ability. Culture and civilization offers each individual the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of giants. Adoption of group identity should constitute apprenticeship, not capitulation. Should constitute a developmental stage in disciplined maturation, requiring temporary subjugation and immolation of immature individuality, prior to its later reemergence in controllable form under voluntary direction. Group membership, social being, represents a necessary advance over childish dependence, but the spirit of the group requires its pound of flesh. Absolute identification with the group means rejection of individual difference, means rejection of deviation, even weakness from the group viewpoint, means repression of individuality, sacrifice of the mythic fool, means abandonment of the simple and insufficient younger brother. The group, of course, merely feels that it is doing its duty by insisting upon such sacrifice. It believes, with sufficient justification, that it is merely protecting its structure. However, the group is not capable of making final judgments regarding what is necessary, what is good and what is evil, because it is incomplete by its very nature. It is a static structure composed of the past. Individual difference, even weakness, anathema to the absolutist, is strength from a more inclusive viewpoint. Is that force capable of transcending inevitable group limitation and extending the reach of all? Absolutists, rejecting the necessity of all change, necessarily deny to themselves and others even their own strength, because true heroism, regardless of its source, has the capacity to upset the status quo. Through such denial, the absolutist hopes to find protection from his individual vulnerability. In truth, however, he has suppressed and pathologized the sole element within himself that could actually provide such protection. He has undermined his ability to utilize the sole process capable of actually providing security and freedom. As Nietzsche comments, a traveler who had seen many countries and peoples and several continents was asked what human traits he had found everywhere. And he answered, "Men are inclined to laziness." Some will feel that he might have said with greater justice, "They are all timorous. They hide behind customs and opinions." At bottom, every human being knows very well that he is in this world just once, as something unique. and that no accident, however strange, will throw together a second time into a unity such a curious and diffuse plurality. He knows it, but hides it like a bad conscience. Why? From fear of his neighbor who insists on convention and veils himself with it. But what is it that compels the individual human being to fear his neighbor, to think and act herd fashion, and not to be glad of himself? A sense of shame, perhaps, in a few rare cases. In the vast majority, it is the desire for comfort, inertia. In short, that inclination to laziness of which the traveler spoke. He is right. Men are even lazier than they are timorous, and what they fear most is the troubles with which any unconditional honesty and nudity would burden them. Only artists hate this slovenly life in borrowed manners and loosely fitting opinions and unveil the secret, everybody's bad conscience, the principle that every human being is a unique wonder. They dare to show us the human being as he is, down to the last muscle, himself and himself alone. Even more, that in this rigorous consistency of his uniqueness, he is beautiful and worth contemplating, as novel and incredible as every work of nature, and by no means dull. When a great thinker despises men, it is their laziness that he despises. For it is on account of this that they have the appearance of factory products and seem indifferent and unworthy of companionship or instruction. The human being who does not wish to belong to the mass must merely cease being comfortable with himself. Let him follow his conscience, which shouts at him, "Be yourself." What you are at present doing, opining, and desiring? That is not really you. Denial of unique individuality turns the wise traditions of the past into the blind ruts of the present. Application of the letter of the law when the spirit of the law is necessary makes a mockery of culture. Following in the footsteps of others seems safe and requires no thought, but it is useless to follow a well-trodden trail when the terrain itself has changed. The individual who fails to modify his habits and presumptions as a consequence of change is deluding himself, is denying the world, is trying to replace reality itself with his own feeble wish. By pretending things are other than they are, he undermines his own stability, destabilizes his future, and transforms the past from shelter to prison. The individual embodiment of collective past wisdom is turned into the personification of inflexible stupidity by means of the lie. The lie is straightforward voluntary rejection of what is currently known to be true. Nobody knows what is finally true by definition, but honest people make the best possible use of their experience. The moral theories of the truthful, however incomplete from some hypothetical transcendent perspective, account for what they have seen and for who they are, insofar as that has been determined in the course of diligent effort. It is not necessary to define truth, to have seen and heard everything. That would make truth itself something impossible. It is necessary only to have represented and adapted to what has been seen and heard, to have represented and adapted to those phenomena characterizing the natural and social worlds as encountered and the self as manifested. This is to say, merely, that the truth of children and adults differs because their experience, their reality, differs. The truthful child does not think like an adult. He thinks like a child with his eyes open. The adult, however, who still uses the morality of the child despite his adult capacities, he is lying, and he knows it. The lie is willful adherence to a previously functional schema of action and interpretation, a moral paradigm, despite new experience that cannot be comprehended in terms of that schema. despite new desire which cannot find fulfillment within that framework. The lie is willful rejection of information apprehended as anomalous on terms defined and valued by the individual doing the rejecting. That is to say, the liar chooses his own game, sets his own rules, and then cheats. This cheating is failure to grow, to mature. It is rejection of the process of consciousness itself. The lie is therefore not so much a sin of commission in most cases as a sin of omission, although it may take the former condition as well. The lie is a matter of voluntary failure to explore and to update. The appearance of an anomalous occurrence in the ongoing stream of experience indicates only that the present goal-directed schema within which behavior is being undertaken and evaluated is characterized by the presence of a flaw. The place of the flaw, the reasons for its existence, the meaning of the flaw, its potential for altering interpretation and behavior, all that is hypothetical at the first stage of anomaly emergence and analysis. The unknown has to be mined for precise significance before it can be said to have been experienced, let alone comprehended, has to be transformed laboriously from pure affect into revision of presumption and action, into psyche or personality. Not doing is therefore the simplest and most common lie. The individual can just not act, not investigate, and the pitfalls of error will remain unmanifest, at least temporarily. This rejection of the process of creative exploration means lack of effortful update of procedural and declarative memory, adaptation to the present as if it still were the past, refusal to think. The rectification of error is, after all, not inevitable. It is neither effortless nor automatic. Mediation of order and chaos requires courage and work. Adoption of identity with the heroes of the past is necessary, but rife with pathological potential. It becomes certain corruption when the identified individual is a liar who has voluntarily rendered himself incapable of personal heroism. Adoption of group identity and position means access to the power embodied in the past, means access to the collective strength and technical ability of the culture. This power is terribly dangerous in cowardly and deceitful hands. The liar cannot see any value in weakness or deviance in himself or others, only the potential for chaos, and he cannot see any value in chaos or uncertainty. He has no sympathy or patience for or appreciation of his own weaknesses or his own strengths, and can therefore have none for the weakness or strength of others. The liar can only pretend to embody what is best of the past because he cannot support or tolerate the presence of necessary deviance in the present. This means that the liar is a tyrant because he cannot stand being a fool. The liar cannot tolerate anomaly because it provokes anxiety, and the liar does not believe that he can or should withstand anxiety. This means that he is motivated to first avoid and then to actively suppress any behavioral pattern or experience of world that does not fit comfortably into his culturally determined system of affect-regulating moral presuppositions. Avoidance means that anomalous experience is kept unconscious, so to speak, which means incompletely realized. The implications of the dangerous thought remain unconsidered. The presence of the threatening fantasy remains unadmitted. The existence of the unacceptable personal action remains unrecognized. Active suppression does not mean intrapsychic repression in the classic sense, but aggressive action undertaken in the world to forcibly eliminate evidence of error. This may mean treachery, spiritual cruelty, or the outright application of power. may mean application of whatever maneuver is presumed necessary to destroy all indication of insufficiency. The bearer of bad news therefore inevitably suffers at the hand of the deceitful individual who would rather kill the source of potential wisdom than benefit from its message. The lie is easy and rewarding as it allows for the avoidance of anxiety, at least in the short term. In the long run, however, the lie has terrible consequences. The avoidance or suppression of novel or unexpected experience, which is the abstract equivalent of running away, transforms it perforce into determinate threat, is the categorical equivalent of labeling as threat. The domain of unprocessed novelty, defined prima facie by inaction and avoidance as threat too intolerable to face, expands inevitably with time when the past is held as absolute. More and more experience is therefore rendered intolerable, inexplicable, and chaotic as the cumulative effects of using the lie as a mode of adaptation inexorably manifest themselves. The lie transforms culture into tyranny, change into danger, while sickening and restricting the development and flexibility of adaptive ability itself. Reliance on the lie ensures, as fear grows, heightened, pathologized identification with the past, manifested as fascism, personal and political intolerance, or decadent degeneration, manifested as nihilism, personal and social deterioration. Identification with the spirit of denial eventually makes life unbearable as everything new, and therefore everything defining hope, comes to be axiomatically regarded as punishment and threat. Makes life unbearable as the realm of acceptable action shrinks inexorably. The attendant and unavoidable suffering experienced generates the desire for and motivates actions predicated on the attainment of the end of all experience as compensation and revenge for sterility, absence of meaning, anxiety, hatred, and pain. As in this story cited by Ellen Edwardes and R.E.L. Masters. The Marabout, North African hermit or holy man, draws a large circle in the dirt, which represents the world. He places a scorpion, symbolic of man, inside the circle. The scorpion, believing it has achieved freedom, starts to run around the circle, but never attempts to go outside. After the scorpion has raced several times around the inside edge of the circle, the marabout lowers his stick and divides the circle in half. The scorpion stops for a few seconds, then begins to run faster and faster, apparently looking for a way out, but never finding it. Strangely enough, the scorpion does not dare to cross over the line. After a few minutes, the marabout divides the half circle. The scorpion becomes frantic. Soon, the marabout makes a space no bigger than the scorpion's body. This is the moment of truth. The scorpion, dazed and bewildered, finds itself unable to move one way or another. Raising its venomous tail, the scorpion turns rapidly, round and round, in a veritable frenzy, whirling, whirling, whirling until all of its spirit and energy are spent. In utter hopelessness, the scorpion stops, lowers the poisonous point of its tail, and stings itself to death. Its torment is ended. The individual who lives by the lie continually shrinks his domain of competence, his explored and familiar territory. Eventually, in consequence, he has nowhere left to turn, except to himself. But his own personality has, in the meantime, become shrunken and inept as a consequence of underdevelopment, as a consequence of repeated failure to participate in the process that turns pre-cosmogonic matter into spirit and world. Nothing remains but weakness, resentment, hatred, and fear. Thus, the chaos that is rejected out of desire for too much security attains its inevitable victory. The vicious circle created by the liar spirals down inevitably to the underworld. This process is schematically represented in Figure 58, the vicious circle of the adversary. The patriarchal system, the known, is the concrete consequence of past adaptation, the hierarchically integrated and represented residue of the heroic past. Such adaptation is necessarily incomplete in that the full scope of natural phenomena always exceeds the capacity for interpretation. Absolutist application of the past, motivated by fear of the unknown, transforms the past perforce into tyranny, which does not tolerate inevitable individual or deviant experience. This process of absolute ancestral deification is the consequence of security seeking, made necessary by the abandonment of individual heroism as a potential mode of adaptation. Such abandonment occurs as a consequence of premature and arrogant self-definition, definition that makes of evident human vulnerability final and sufficient evidence for the unbearable cruelty of God and the uselessness of man. The constant search for security, rather than the embodiment of freedom, is wish for rule by law's letter, rather than law's spirit. The resultant forcible suppression of deviance is based upon desire to support the pretense that the unknown does not exist. This suppression has as its consequence the elimination of creative transformation from the individual and social spheres. The individual who denies his identification with the heroic will come to identify with and serve the tyrannical force of the past, and to suffer the consequences. This principle is aptly illustrated by the mythic story of Judas. Judas sacrifices Christ, the hero, to the authorities of tradition, for all the best reasons, and is then driven to destroy himself in despair. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? See thou to that." And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, and departed, and went, and hanged himself. Matthew 27:3-5. Sacrifice of the hero to the great and terrible father means abandonment of identification with the process that makes cosmos out of chaos. Rejection of the process whereby the endlessly negative and terrifying is transformed into the acceptable and beneficial means, by definition, the end of all hope. Wherefore I say unto you, all manner of sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men. But the blasphemy against the Holy Ghost shall not be forgiven unto men. And whosoever speaketh a word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven him. But whosoever speaketh against the Holy Ghost, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this world, neither in the world to come. Matthew 12:31-32. The individual lies to convince himself and others that he embodies the greatness of the past. He pretends to be upright and courageous instead of acting morally and bravely. Truly courageous actions might turn the group against him, and it is only identity with that group that keeps his head above water. The lie means denial of self, means the abandonment of mythic identity with God, means certain involuntary revolutionary collapse in time. The lie means conscious refusal to modify and reconfigure historically predicated behavior and belief to incorporate novelty and alleviate threat. Endless failure to voluntarily update means the generation of a morass around the individual where the water of life once existed, What could be life-giving liquid becomes a deadly swamp, composed of past errors, unresolved traumas, and current difficulties. This is the domain characterized by Freud as the unconscious into which repressed memories are cast. But unprocessed information is not precisely memory. That which has not yet been explored is not yet memorable, not yet even real. The consequence of untaken action is more accurately potential from which spirit and world could be constructed, much of it implicit in the world as it currently exists, instead of stored in memory. Implicit, that is, in the form of unencountered but latent trouble, in the form of the unanswered letter, the unpaid debt, or the unresolved dispute. This self-generated swamp grows increasingly impenetrable as time passes, becomes increasingly uninhabitable as the consequences of long-term avoidance propagate, as the monsters of the bog sprout new and hungry heads. This accumulation of pre-cosmogonic potential is tantamount to reanimation of the dragon of chaos, is precisely equivalent to the reawakening of Tiamat, who eternally sleeps under the secure and familiar world. The more restricted, fear-bound, faithless, and repressive the particular mode of adaptation, that is, the more extreme the lie, the more horrendous, dangerous, intolerable, and powerful the associated dragon. It is in this manner that attitude comes to define the world. Every attempt to wish any aspect of experience out of existence transforms it into an enemy. Every facet of being hidden from the light leads a corrupt and sun-starved existence underground. Experience, absolute reality itself in the final analysis, cannot be denied without consequence. Reality cannot be fantasized out of existence. The enforcement of a wish merely ensures that the information contained in the denied experience can neither be removed from the domain of threat nor utilized for adaptive purposes. It is possible that we are, in fact, adapted to the world, that we are adapted to the world as it actually exists, rather than to the world as we wish it might be. It is possible that our experience contains information precisely sufficient to ensure our happy survival. This means that every task left undone, every emergent territory left unexplored, comprises latent information from which competent personality could yet be extracted. If experience is valid as source of world and spirit, then those elements of experience that have been avoided or suppressed or devalued may yet contain within them what is absolutely essential to continued successful existence. Voluntary movement toward the good would therefore mean reintegration of cast-off material, voluntary incorporation of that which appears at present indigestible. The alternative to this voluntary pursuit of the inedible is eventual psychological catastrophe at the social or individual level, engendered through involuntary contact with the hostile forces of rejected being. From the mythological perspective, this psychological catastrophe is accidental reunion with the terrible mother on territory of her choosing. This Oedipal incest culminates in certain suffering on the part of the unwilling hero, culminates in suicide, dismemberment, castration, ends in the final sacrifice of masculine consciousness and in the victory of the underworld. The identity of the individual with his culture protects him from the terrible unknown and allows him to function as an acceptable member of society. This slavish function strengthens the group. But the group states that certain ways of thinking and acting are all that are acceptable, and these particular ways do not exhaust the unknown and necessary capabilities of the human being. The rigid, grinning social mask is the individual's pretense that he is the same person as everyone else, that is, the same dead person, that he is not a natural disaster, not a stranger, not strange, that he is not deviant, weak, cowardly, inferior, and vengeful. The true individual, however, the honest fool, stands outside the protective enclave of acceptance, unredeemed, the personification of weakness, inferiority, vengefulness, cowardice, difference. He cannot make the cut, and because he cannot make the cut, he is the target of the tyranny of the group and of his own judgment, insofar as he is that group. But man as a fool, weak, ignorant, and vulnerable, is what the group is not. A true individual, truly existing, truly experiencing, truly suffering, if it could only be admitted. Consciousness of intrinsic personal limitation and apprehension of its consequences brings clear definition of the nature of subjective experience when allowed to surface, and fosters attempts to adapt to that experience. It is for this reason that only the unredeemed, the outcast, the sick, the blind, and the lame can be saved. Apprehension of the true nature of subjective experience, of individual reality outside the delusionary constraints of the group, is of sufficient power to demoralize absolutely. The eternal consequence of self-consciousness is therefore the expulsion from Eden in its maternal and patriarchal forms. But such a fall is a step on the way to the true paradise, is a step toward adoption of identity with the hero who is not protected from the vagaries of existence, but who can actively transform the terrible unknown into the sustenant and productive world. Acceptance, at least recognition, of the mortal limitation characterizing human experience, therefore constitutes the precondition for proper adaptation. The lie, which denies individual experience, is denial of the fool, but the fool is the truth. Acceptance of mortal weakness is the paradoxical humility that serves as precondition for true heroism. The heroic attitude is predicated on the belief that something new and valuable still exists to be encountered and assimilated, regardless of the power and stability of the current position. This belief is further based upon faith in human potential, upon faith that the individual spirit will respond to challenge and flourish. Such belief must be posited voluntarily, freely, prior to participation in any heroic endeavor. This is the necessary leap that makes courageous and creative action possible, that makes religion something real. Humility means, therefore, I am not yet what I could be. This is an adage both cautious and hopeful. The adversarial position, deceit, is predicated on the belief that the knowledge of the present comprises all necessary knowledge, is predicated on the belief that the unknown has finally been conquered. This belief is equivalent to denial of vulnerability, equivalent to the adoption of omniscience. What I do is all there is to do. What I know is all there is to know. Inextricably associated with the adoption of such a stance is denial, implicit or explicit, of the existence, the possibility, and the necessity of the heroic, as everything worthwhile has already been done, as all problems have been solved, as paradise has already been spread before us. This is a terrible position. As the axiom of faith, we are redeemed, makes human suffering itself, which can never be eradicated as a consequence of ideological identification, something heretical, something that can exist only as an insult to the guardians of traditional order. The authoritarian is thereby necessarily stripped of his empathy, even for himself. In the perfect world presently extant, nothing imperfect may be allowed to exist. So the adversary backs himself into a position where he cannot admit even to his own misery, let alone the misery of others. A more hopeless position cannot possibly be imagined. Acceptance of insufficiency paradoxically catalyzes identification with the hero and opens up the possibility of participation in the process of creation and renewal. Rejection of insufficiency produces, by contrast, identification with the adversary, whose eternal dwelling place is hell. This hell is something whose nature can be rendered explicitly comprehensible, despite its mythological character, is something that has familiar and defined features, is something that can be understood, first and foremost, as a consequence of the imbalance of the constituent elements of reality. Adoption of the deceitful or adversarial mode of adaptation produces an accelerated search for security and increased likelihood of aggression in those cases where identification with the cultural canon is deemed possible, or degeneration of personality and decadent breakdown, where the costs of cultural identity are regarded as too high, where no such identity is waiting to offer protection, or where even fascistic behavior appears as something too positive to manifest in the all-too-unbearable world. Denial of the heroic promotes fascism, absolute identification with the cultural canon. Everything that is known within a particular historically determined framework, predicated upon mythologically expressed assumptions. Denial or avoidance of the unknown therefore concomitantly necessitates deification of a particular previously established viewpoint. The way that things are under such circumstances must be the way they forever remain. Questioning the wisdom of the past necessarily exposes the anxiety-provoking unknown once again to view. This exposure of the unknown can be regarded as beneficial under those circumstances where positive adaptation to the unknown is viewed as possible, but only as destructive where lack of faith in the heroic rules. All that lives, however, grows. When conservatism destroys the capacity for individual creativity, when it becomes tyranny, then it works against life, not for it. The spirit within has withdrawn from the group afraid to develop. An absolutely conservative society cannot survive because the future transcends the limitations of the past, and the absolute conservative wants to limit what could be to what has already been. If history was complete and perfect, if the individual had fully exploited his highest potential, then the human race would be run, for all would be explored, all known, all accomplished. But this pinnacle of attainment has not yet been reached, and perhaps never will be. Those who pretend the contrary rapidly come to actively oppose the very process that delivers what they claim to have already obtained. Denial of the heroic promotes decadence equally. Absolute rejection of the order of tradition. Absolute rejection of order itself. This pattern of apprehension and behavior seems far removed from that of the fascist, but the decadent is just as arrogant as his evidently more rigid peer. He has merely identified himself absolutely with no thing rather than with one thing. He is rigidly convinced of the belief that nothing matters, convinced that nothing is of value despite the opinions of clearly deluded, weak, and despicable others, convinced that nothing is worth the effort. The decadent functions in this manner like an anti-Midas. Everything he touches turns to ashes. Under normal circumstances, the individual who reaches adolescence identifies with the tribe, with the collective, historically determined structure designed to deal with threat. The normal individual solves his problem of adaptation to the unknown by joining a group. A group, by definition, is composed of those who have adopted a central structure of value and who therefore behave in the presence of other group members identically, and, if not identically, at least predictably. The fascist adapts to the group with a vengeance. He builds stronger and stronger walls around himself and those who are like him in an ever more futile attempt to keep the threatening unknown at bay. He does this because his worldview is incomplete. He does not believe in the heroic aspect of the individual, does not see the negative aspect of the social world, and cannot visualize the beneficial aspect of chaos. He is frightened enough to develop the discipline of a slave so that he can maintain his protected position in the group, but he is not frightened enough to transcend his slavish condition. He therefore remains twisted and bent. The decadent, by contrast, sees nothing but the tyranny of the state. Since the adversarial aspect of the individual remains conveniently hidden from his view, he cannot perceive that his rebellion is nothing but avoidance of discipline. He views chaos as a beneficial home, seeing the source of human evil in social regulation, because he cannot imagine the terrible mother as soul-devouring force. So, he abandons his father in the belly of the beast, unredeemed, and has no tools to rely on when he finally faces a true challenge. The decadent looks to subvert the process of maturation, looks for a way out of group affiliation. Group membership requires adoption of at least adolescent responsibility, and this burden may seem too much to bear as a consequence of prolonged immaturity of outlook. The decadent therefore acts as if the paradigmatic structure of the group has been rendered insufficient as a consequence of environmental, cultural, or intellectual change and refuses to be the fool who risks belief. The proper response to the illness of the father is, of course, the journey to the land of living water. The decadent makes his intellectual superiority to the superstitions of the past an article of faith instead, and shirks his responsibility. That is to say, it is the desire to shirk that responsibility and the heroic sacrifice it entails that constitutes motivation for belief in intellectual superiority. The suffering rebel stance that such adoption allows as a secondary consequence also serves admirably as mask for cowardice. The fascist and the decadent regard each other as opposites, as mortal enemies. They are in actuality two sides of the same bent coin, as expressed by R. Durnan. Today is Christmas Day, and I have just come home from Julie's. While I was there, it struck me, as I sat on their couch between the two girls, just how foolish and idiotic I have been in this, my only life. I hope you will have patience while I unburden myself on you, because I need desperately to confess my sins to someone, and I know that if I were sitting in a little cubicle talking to an unseen clergyman, I wouldn't do a proper job of it. You fit the definition of a religious man as someone who gives careful consideration to the demonic and irrational in humanity, so I think you will find my confession interesting. Imagine, if you can, a grown man who harbors in his heart the most vicious resentment for his fellow man, his neighbor, who is guilty of nothing more than embodying a superior consciousness of what it means to be a man. When I think of all the black, scathing thoughts I have directed at those who I could not look in the eye, it is almost unbearable. All of my lofty disdain for the common man who, so I thought, was guilty of the sin of unconsciousness, was, I now realize, founded on nothing more than jealousy and spite. I hated, I absolutely loathed anyone who had wrestled with their fear of leaving the maternal confines of a childish mentality and won their battle, only because I had not done so. I equated independence and success with egotism and selfishness, and it was my fondest hope, my highest ambition, to witness and participate in the destruction of everything that successful, independent people had built for themselves. This I considered a duty. In fact, there was a decidedly fanatical element in my urge to cleanse the world of what I perceived to be selfishness. Think what would have happened if I had been in a position to realize my fine feelings. The memory makes me fear that any moment the earth will crack open and swallow me up, because if there is any justice, it would. I, who had not the faintest inkling of a capacity for moral judgment, traipsing around, passing judgment on anyone who dared cross my path. It makes me wonder that I have even one friend in this world. But of course, I had friends before. Anyone with enough self-contempt that they could forgive me mine. It is fortunate for humanity that there are few saviors of the caliber of myself. Did you know that I used to identify with Christ? I considered myself entirely, immaculately free of aggression and every other form of antisocial feeling. But what about the hatred I have just now confessed, you ask? That didn't count. Those feelings were based on sound common sense, you see. After all, there are sons of bitches in the world, and one needs to be ready for them. Do I smell ozone? They say you get a tingling sensation just before the lightning bolt strikes. That is a very apt phrase, son of a bitch. There is a passage in Jung's Phenomenology of the Self which runs, "Often a mother appears beside him, who apparently shows not the slightest concern that her little son should become a man, but who, with tireless and self-immolating effort, neglects nothing that might hinder him from growing up and marrying. You now behold the secret conspiracy between mother and son, and how each helps the other to betray life." This insight would be useful for me as an excuse, being a perfectly accurate description of my situation, were it not for the fact that I am almost daily presented with a residual bit of undiluted evil in myself. For example, when I am faced with a frustrating situation, I do not ask myself what I am going to do about it. I ask myself who is responsible for it. And I am always ready to conclude that if the other person were to act properly, then the problem would not exist. What is evil about that, you ask? Obviously, if I am determined to overlook my own part in the failure to resolve my own frustrations, if I am determined to find a scapegoat for my problems, then I am just a stone's throw away from the mentality that was responsible for Hitler's final solution, or for the Spanish Inquisition, or for Lenin's cultural cleansing. What was it you told me when I complained about the flaws in capitalism, about the fact that so many people take advantage of the capitalist system? Something like, "The fact that people go on consolidating their financial position ad nauseam is another problem, but it is no reason to conclude that there is anything virtuous in refusing to even try to consolidate one's position in the first place." But it is so much easier to crown one's cowardice and laziness with the accolade of virtue. Just ask Lenin's henchmen, who swaggered around the countryside, robbing every farmer who had managed any success whatever, and called themselves friends of the common people and patted each other on the back for their moral uprightness. I wonder if I have changed so much that I would not join them when put to the test. The idea that morality stems from a lack of personal interests is thoroughly ingrained in my mind. Good people are those who don't want anything for themselves, is the way I think. But I never ask myself why such a person should put any effort into disciplining himself or take any pains to keep his motives clear in his own mind, because there is nothing of value to him in this world. In his essay, Relations Between the Ego and the Unconscious, Jung says that in an unconscious state, the individual is torn by the conflict of opposites, and that achieving consciousness involves resolving that conflict on a higher level. I understand that this particular state of adult unconsciousness is different from the original state of childlike unconsciousness in which there is no long-term conflict. Just last week, I was stuck in that dead end again. I was sitting and thinking about what course my life should be taking, and at every imagined scenario of a fulfilling or meaningful activity, I was met by a counterpoint coming from somewhere in my head, showing me how this or that aspect of my scenario was wrong because it would result in this or that problem, to the point where it was unacceptable to consider any career at all, because just by being alive, I would contribute to the destruction of the planet. And as badly as I wanted to refute this echo of wrong to my every imagined right as an irrational chimera, the fact is, so I told myself, that we see daily in the newspapers how the activities of humanity, which are also the activities of individual men and women, are causing incalculable harm. It is, of course, due to my being influenced by yourself that I do not remain stuck in that particular bog too long these days. If our industrialism is causing problems, I now answer myself, then I should hope that there are people out there working to solve those problems, or perhaps I should try to do something about them myself. But by sitting idly by, I do not solve a thing. Of course, what is most daunting, and also most snivelly, about being stuck in that bog is the fact that the rational mind wants to be absolutely sure about the successful outcome of its life plan. And obviously, there is another part of the mind that knows that such certainty is impossible. So one is then faced with the need to accept on faith that things will turn out for the better with some luck and perseverance. And, being a fine, upstanding modern mouse with an enlightened rational mind, I have no use for faith and other such religious-sounding claptrap and nonsense. Faith is obviously irrational, and I'll not have any irrationality influencing my behavior. Previously, my solution to this problem was to allow chance to make my career choices for me, letting my own interests influence my decisions as little as possible, and I then believed that I had somehow avoided personal responsibility for the state of the modern world, because I was not really responsible for the state of my life, and that I had escaped from the possibility that my plans wouldn't work out, because I had no plans. It was on this rock-solid foundation that I looked out at the world and saw around me people who were stupid enough to add their own selves into the equation. To put this kind of faith in oneself, to believe that there exists inside of oneself a motive force, call it an interest, which will respond to life and carry one through uncertainty and adversity, is an irrational attitude without equal. And it is with this irrational approach to life that the conflict of the opposites is resolved, it seems to me. But the problem now is this. In order to have this faith in one's irrational nature, one needs proof that personal interests and passions are capable of sustaining one through the uncertainties and adversities of life that the rational mind foresees so clearly. And the only way to get that proof is to risk oneself and see the result. It is a very exceptional person who can take such an undertaking on their own. Most of us need guidance and support from others, from believers, so to speak. Strange, isn't it, that religious terms should become useful for this discussion? As I wrote that last paragraph, I was suddenly reminded of your idea that the devil, as he is represented in Milton's Paradise Lost, is a metaphor for the rational intellect placed in the position of the highest psychic authority. Better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. Hell, then, is a condition in which the rational mind, with its acute consciousness of the many perils of life, holds sway over the individual and effectively prevents him from engaging in life, which results in the morally degenerate state of weakness that I described in the first pages of this letter. And heaven, I presume, would be a condition in which the rational mind subordinates itself to faith in God. But what is God? You have a chapter in the manuscript of your book titled The Divinity of Interest. Your ideas are starting to make sense to me now. At least I think they are. Faith in God means faith in that which kindles one's interest and leads one away from the parental sphere out into the world. To deny those interests is to deny God, to fall from heaven and land squarely in hell, where one's passions burn eternally in frustration. What was it God said when he cast Adam out of Eden? Something about working in the dust to the end of his days, with the specter of death always looming in the future. I can certainly relate to that. One of the most vivid impressions I get from recalling all those years I spent moving from one job to the next is the pointlessness of my daily life back then and the glaring knowledge that the end was drawing near. But when I'm doing something that has meaning for me, something that interests me, as I am right now, death seems far away, and work seems quite agreeable, even joyous. This theory of the genesis of social psychopathology, this theory of a direct relationship obtaining between personal choice and fascistic or decadent personality and social movement, finds its precise echo in Taoist philosophy, and can be more thoroughly comprehended through application of that perspective. The traditional Taoist believes that profane human experience consists of the differentiated parts of an essentially uncategorizable background, the Tao, which may also be interpreted as meaning or as the way. Tao manifests itself as the eternal flux of being. The natural categories of yin and yang, represented in Figure 59, the constituent elements of existence, reprise, constitute the most fundamental divisions of Tao, the basic, maternal, and patriarchal constituent elements of experience. Much of ancient Chinese philosophy, cosmology, medicine, political theory, religious thinking, is predicated on the idea that pathology is caused by a relative excess of one primordial substance or the other. The goal of the Chinese sage, physician, spiritual leader, or social administrator, is to establish or re-establish harmony between the fundamental feminine and masculine principles, and to diagnose and cure the faulty action or irresponsible inactions that led to their original discord. The schematic representation of yin and yang, portrayed in Figure 59, utilizes the image of a circle to represent totality. The serpents that make up that circle are opposed but balanced. The image is rendered additionally sophisticated by the presence of the white circle in the black serpent and vice versa. Too much chaos breeds desire for order. Yin may therefore serve as mother to yang. Conversely, too much order breeds the desire for novelty as antidote to stultifying predictability. In this manner, yang serves as father to yin. The fascist, who will not face the reality and necessity of the unknown, hides his vulnerable face in a pathological excess of order. The decadent, who refuses to see that existence is not possible without order, hides his immaturity from himself and others in a pathological excess of chaos. The fascist is willing to sacrifice painful freedom for order and to pretend that his unredeemed misery is meaningless so that he does not have to do anything for himself. The decadent believes that freedom can be attained without discipline and responsibility, because he is ignorant of the terrible nature of the undifferentiated ground of reality and is unwilling to bear the burden of order. When he starts to suffer, as he certainly will not allow the reality of his suffering to prove to him that some things are real, because acceptance of that proof would force him to believe and to act, would force him as well toward painful realization of the counterproductive and wasteful stupidity of his previous position. The fascistic mode of adaptation is, above all, a method for the direct control of the unknown and unpredictable. Modern human beings, like the ancients, identify the stranger implicitly with the dragon of chaos. The stranger acts unpredictably and thinks unpredictable things, things which might have dramatic and unsettling effect if they were allowed full expression. Extreme conservatism allows for restriction of uncertainty, for evasion of the unknown. It performs this function by ensuring that each member of the group acts, imagines, and thinks precisely like every other member, generally, precisely like the leader, a dark parody of the hero. In times of heightened uncertainty, periods of increased unemployment or unsettled political structure, the call for return to the glorious past therefore always arises. The fascist, dominated by his fear, believes that the world should only be order because disorder is too frightening to consider. This makes the cosmos he creates, when granted the opportunity, a place of endless sterility and machine-like organization. This increased conformity allows at least for the temporary alleviation and restriction of anxiety, but damages the capacity of the group, his group, that is, to respond flexibly to inevitable change. It is as if, to use a biological metaphor, the fascist strives to force all the genetic diversity out of his species. No diversity means no variance in response to new challenges, means one solution, likely the wrong one, to every problem. The suppression of deviance, of the unknown, therefore merely ensures its irrepressible emergence in negative guise at some undetermined point in the future, as problems ignored do not go away, but get worse as they follow their own peculiar developmental path. The order the fascist imposes, therefore, bears within it the seeds of its own destruction. The fascist tends to be cruel as well as rigid, and will pursue his cruelty even at the cost of his own stability. The Nazi persecution of the Jews, for example, continued at an increasing rate and with increasingly harsh procedures as it became more and more evidently a burden to the war effort. Nazi hatred therefore became a force so potent as the Third Reich developed that it overcame Nazi patriotism motivated by mortal terror of the unknown. Underneath the fascists' professed patriotism and cowardly love of order is an even more profound phenomenon: hatred for the tragic conditions of existence and for the vulnerable life that makes those conditions evident. For they reasoned unsoundly, saying to themselves, "Short and sorrowful is our life, and there is no remedy when a man comes to his end, and no one has been known to return from Hades. Because we were born by mere chance, and hereafter we shall be as though we had never been. Because the breath in our nostrils is smoke, and reason is a spark kindled by the beating of our hearts. When it is extinguished, the body will turn to ashes, and the spirit will dissolve like empty air. Our name will be forgotten in time, and no one will remember our works. Our life will pass away like the traces of a cloud and be scattered like mist that is chased by the rays of the sun and overcome by its heat. For our allotted time is the passing of a shadow, and there is no return from our death because it is sealed up and no one turns back. Come, therefore, let us enjoy the good things that exist and make use of the creation to the full as in youth. Let us take our fill of costly wine and perfumes, and let no flower of spring pass by us. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they wither. Let none of us fail to share in our revelry. Everywhere let us leave signs of enjoyment, because this is our portion, and this our lot. Let us oppress the righteous poor man. Let us not spare the widow, nor regard the gray hairs of the aged, but let our might be our law of right, for what is weak proves itself to be useless. Wisdom 2:1-11. Fascist cruelty is motivated by the affective consequences of pathologically increased order. When the water of life dries up, nothing is left of existence but its inevitable pains and frustrations, compounded by terrible boredom. Furthermore, anomaly inevitably accumulates as order is imposed in an increasingly strict manner. This adds increased apprehension of chaos to pain, frustration, and stultification. Individuals subjected to a surfeit of such emotions have every reason to be vengeful, aggressive, and cruel. They have placed themselves in a state where the emergence of such motivation is certain. The unknown appears only when there has been error. The fascist says, "I know everything there is to know." He cannot, therefore, make an error. But error is the mother of all things. The inability to admit to imperfection, therefore, means withdrawal from every informative situation. This means death of continued adaptation and certain future reemergence of the unknown in negative guise. If you do not change in the face of constant slow transformation, then the discrepancies and unresolved errors pile up and accumulate. The more stubborn, read, arrogant you are, the longer the period of time during which this accretion occurs. Sooner or later, so much unknown surrounds you that it is no longer avoidable. At that point, the dragon of the underworld emerges and swallows you whole. Then you live in the belly of the beast, in darkness, in the night, in the kingdom of the dead. Hatred comes easily in such an environment. The decadent says, "There is no such thing as to know," and never attempts to accomplish anything. Like his authoritarian counterpart, he makes himself immune from error, since mistakes are always made with regard to some valued, fixed, and desired end. The decadent says, "Look, here is something new, something inexplicable. That is evidence, is it not, that everything that I have been told is wrong. History is unreliable. Rules are arbitrary. Accomplishment is illusory. Why do anything under such circumstances?" But he is living on borrowed time, feeding like a parasite on the uncomprehended body of the past. If he works sufficiently hard and saws off the branch on which he is sitting, then he will fall too into the jaws of the thing he ignored. The habitual act of avoidance, of rejection, weakens the personality in a direct causal manner. The strength of a personality might be defined in part as its breadth of explored territory, its capacity to act appropriately in the greatest number of circumstances. Such strength is evidently dependent upon prior learning, at least upon learning how to act. And knowledge of how to act is generated and renewed as a consequence of constant, voluntary, exploratory behavior. If everything new and different is rejected out of hand, the personality cannot adjust itself to changing circumstances. Circumstances change inevitably, however, as a consequence of simple maturation, as a consequence of entropy itself. It is of little use to be entirely prepared for the past. Furthermore, it is only possible to remain prepared for the future by facing the present. Anomaly is, therefore, spiritual food in the most literal sense. The unknown is the raw material out of which the personality is manufactured in the course of exploratory activity. The act of rejecting anomaly transforms the personality into something starved, something senile, and something increasingly terrified of change, as each failure to face the truth undermines capacity to face truth in the future. The man who comes to adopt an inappropriate attitude toward the unknown severs his connection with the source of all knowledge, undermining his personality, perhaps irreparably. This dissolution of strength is self-perpetuating. Every weakness increases the likelihood of further weakness. For he that hath, to him shall be given, and he that hath not, from him shall be taken even that which he hath. Mark 4:25. The individual who turns away from indications of his own insufficiency increases the probability that he will seek to repress and destroy all information that indicates threat to current belief. Avoided, suppressed, or otherwise undeveloped elements of personality are not accessible for use in conscious adaptation, will in fact offer resistance to such adaptation as a consequence of their resentment at being twisted and ignored. Failure to utilize full human potential severely undermines strength of individual character. Dissociation of action, imagination, and ideation weakens personality. Weakness of personality means inability to bear the weight of the conscious world. The result of the hypocritical suppression of individual differences in the service of the social unit and its intrapsychic representative is frailty in the face of the unknown. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. Mark 3:25. The Adversary in Action, a 20th Century Allegory. Jung once said that any internal state of contradiction, unrecognized, will be played out in the world as fate. This statement carries with it the apparent stamp of mysticism. How could the world play out a psychological condition, or the refusal to recognize a psychological condition? Well, the purpose of abstraction is to represent experience and to manipulate the representations to further successful adaptation. If we both want the same toy, we can argue about our respective rights to it. If the argument fails, or if we refuse to engage in it, we can fight. If we are suffering from moral uncertainty at the philosophical level and cannot settle the internal war, then our behavior reflects our inner disquiet, and we act out our contradictions in behavior, much to our general discredit. Thus, the means of settling a dispute cascade with each failure down the chain of abstraction, from the word to the image to the deed. And those who will not let their outdated identities and beliefs die when they must, kill themselves instead. Alexander Solzhenitsyn describes how order and predictability were thereby established in the Soviet Union during Stalin's extensive reign of terror. An eyewitness has told how executions were carried out at Adak, a camp on the Pechora River. They would take the opposition members with their things out of the camp compound on a prisoner transport at night. And outside the compound stood the small house of the third section. The condemned men were taken into a room one at a time, and there the camp guards sprang on them. Their mouths were stuffed with something soft, and their arms were bound with cords behind their backs. Then they were led out into the courtyard, where harnessed carts were waiting. The bound prisoners were piled on the carts from 5 to 7 at a time, and driven off to the Gorka, the camp cemetery. On arrival, they were tipped into big pits that had already been prepared and buried alive. Not out of brutality, no. It had been ascertained that when dragging and lifting them, it was much easier to cope with living people than with corpses. The work went on for many nights at Adak. And that is how the moral political unity of our party was achieved.